Welcome, everybody. This is Mind the Shift. My name is Anders Bolling. My guest today is once again Angelo Di Lullo, doctor, a writer, spiritual pointer, perhaps even a philosopher. Or how would you describe yourself, Angelo?
Oh, I am a physician. As far as when I talk about non-duality, awakening, etc., I don't know. I don't really think of a title for myself, but maybe something like a facilitator.
Facilitator, yeah. That's good. Good enough. Anyway, warm welcome. It's wonderful to have you back. It's been some, I think, 15 months since we spoke last time. And I've been wanting to, or even longing to, elaborate on some of the themes that we talked about that back then, elaborate on the one topic that you ever talk about, namely awakening and realization. So I thought we shouldn't spend too much time this time to actually talk about what it is. I mean, in a sense, we will, of course, but I want to kind of elaborate on both the individual aspects of it and the collective aspects of it, and maybe the philosophical and scientific aspects of it, if that's okay. But we can just, for the audience that have no clue what I'm talking about here, we might just recap a little bit and say something about I should say that I recommend everybody who doesn't know what this awakening process is to listen to our last episode here, yours and mine last episode here on Mind the Shit, which was number 67 from September 2021. And of course, go to Angelo's website and YouTube channel, Simply Always Awake, and read his book, Awake, It's Your Turn. Now, having said that, basically to wake up is to completely change the way you look at reality and life, right? And what's the point of doing that if you just can say that in a few sentences?
Sure. Yeah, I might say it's more than just changing the way you see everything. It's more fundamental than that. It's changing where you see it from. And that might sound like a unimportant distinction or something, but experientially, it's a hugely important distinction. We can change paradigms through which we see the world, through which we see life, ourselves, emotions, thoughts, philosophy. We can change those paradigms subtly, and we can change those paradigms dramatically. I mean, you could change your entire paradigm of how you experience most of life by getting up, moving across the world, living in a completely different culture, looking at different things online, picking up completely different activities than you've ever done before. But that's not awakening, right? It might lead to one, perhaps, but what actually shifts is something, in one sense, far more simple than that. Actually, it brings me back to your introduction. I picked up something you said that I liked, where you said there may be many aspects to it, but there's also only one aspect to this. And it is very paradoxical in that way. So what I'm talking about is something that I'm 100% certain is a common possibility for everyone. This place inside that we can orient to, everybody carries it around. Now, that doesn't mean everyone should or needs to. I don't believe that. But if you feel that there's something inside you've always wanted to address, there's a place inside that it's sort of been there, you've just always kind of not looked there, or maybe even been taught not to look there. And yet something tells you you want to go deeper into your own identity, into life, into beyond meaning and purpose. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the possibility of digging so deeply inside into your intuition that something about your identity actually transforms and actually changes. And it's a very obvious shift when this occurs to people.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that you're not convinced that it is for everybody, which is kind of interesting. I'm going to come back to that, I think, later in this conversation. But I'm not sure, I'm pretty sure that I haven't awakened in the way that you talk about it. But I'm on some kind of a spiritual path, and your videos, your book firstly, and then your videos that you've been releasing now at a fast pace lately have meant a lot to me, because they really resonate. They speak to me, and they kind of put me in a kind of a very particular state when I listen to them, and it feels good. wherever I am when I do that. And you have been, as I said, releasing a lot of videos lately, and you've been, as far as I understand, you have been, you had a lot of clients and you had these retreats, and it seems like it's been an intense period for you on this, concerning this spiritual thing that you're doing. Is that right?
I wouldn't call it intense, but there's been a lot more movement toward this aspect of what I do, this teaching and having retreats and so forth. I personally don't experience it as intense at all, but it's been a lot of change and shift in what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. It's enjoyable. I definitely enjoy it. Yeah. It's fun. It's fun to interact with people in the way we're interacting now and watching them drop into deeper insights and even wake up and so forth.
So what does this mean for your job as a doctor? You're an anesthesiologist, I understand?
Yeah. I mean, I still work full-time right now, but my time has gotten limited to where I don't have as much time as needed to do the things that essentially people are asking me to do, like write the second book and do an audio book. So I've made some adjustments so that I can work a little bit less next year, but I'm still going to work close to full-time, or pretty much full-time, but just taking a handful of less weeks so that I have a little more time freed up to do some more writing, to do some more retreats and so forth. Yeah. So there's shift in that direction.
You're a living example of this. I mean, this freeing yourself from the shackles of time, so to speak, because I mean, to an ordinary person, that would be, I mean, sorry that I'm not calling you an ordinary person, but anyway, this would be described as a stressful period, even if it's a positive kind of stress. But maybe you don't experience stress in that way, in the conventional way. Would you say that you don't do that?
I don't. Yeah, I nothing like I used to, and not like I see people around me in what I would call stressful situations. Although I don't think they're inherently stressful, but I might call conditions which cause people to feel a lot of stress, things like when things change a lot, when things don't go as expected, when you have expectations they don't go your way, especially when there's loss of people, loss of relationships, connections, loss of financial stability, loss of security and safety. Those are the things that definitely cause the stress responses in when we're mind identified, which the vast majority of people in the world are mind identified to some degree. More and more are waking up and in deeper stages of realization, even your reactions to what would typically be called stressful situations and so forth, they can actually drop away. It's hard to imagine, but it's quite surprising when it happens. It's kind of strange. It doesn't mean you don't feel anything and don't respond to your environment. You respond to your environment seamlessly. There's just no unnecessary reactions.
Yeah, it's hard to understand for most people, but yeah, I kind of understand. I kind of get what you're talking about. I have inklings of this at times.
Yeah, I can use an analogy that anyone can relate to. So, for instance, if you think back through your life, or think back through maybe, I don't know, the last year of our lives or something, imagine a certain situation that at one time in your life it happened. Someone maybe said something, or a particular thing happened, and it caused an intense stress response. But then think of another time when that almost the same set of circumstances happened and it just didn't cause a stress response. Now, we don't always notice it, but if you really take inventory, you might notice, wow, okay, so then why did it cause at that time? Mm-hmm. What was there, or what was different when the external circumstances were essentially the same and I just didn't have the reaction? Mm-hmm. So it's something like that. When we're talking about a little deeper stage stuff here, but when we talk about reactivity specifically, it's something that tends to go dormant. I like how Eckhart Tolle uses this term pain body, and he says sometimes it's like dormant and sometimes it's active. That's pretty accurate, especially when it comes to reactivity. It can definitely hide in the background, and you may not even feel like you have reactivity, and then all of a sudden you find out you really do have reactivity. So it's something like that, where there are certain circumstances that tend to cause it, but it's not a definite causal relationship. And you can see that in yourself when you see that, oh, okay, actually, I don't have to react the same way all the time. Huh, okay, well, then let me dig deep and find out what's in the reaction body, what's in the reaction experience. How does that chain of causality affect my behavior, for instance? Yeah. So again, this is like a little bit deeper stage realization stuff, meaning before awakening, it's a little hard to chase that down. It's not impossible. Anything's possible. But I usually recommend people more... take the first step out of mind identification into sort of expanded consciousness first before trying to trace down these very subtle but remarkably affecting of your behavior patterns of belief. Let's say we'll call them beliefs. Yeah. Because they're subtle and they're hard to get to.
And then life becomes, as you often say, very spontaneous, isn't it? I mean, it's like everything just happens in the moment, and it's really difficult to understand if you haven't tried that out. I mean, it's like you shed the future and you shed the past, and it's just this moment, and things happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I can lead anyone in, well, most people, unless they're really bound into their thoughts, but if they're willing to look where I'm pointing, it's not hard to point somebody in the moment to the truth that there really is no actual past. There's a mental past, but you don't ever access it through the mind, through thoughts. There's just thoughts of that are reflections of other thoughts. So you don't really know what happened in the past. And this is scientifically proven that memories change quite significantly. And we can be very convinced that something happened a certain way. And when it's studied under the right circumstances, often we're pretty far off, actually. So the mind does change what we call memories and so forth. So the point is, in the present moment, you don't ever experience the past and you don't ever experience the future. And yet somehow we really ignore that truth, right? We don't feel like that's true. We spend most of our time actually believing and living in this inner world of past and future, right? So
we're actually living in an illusion, really.
It is very much like a simulation. Now, who's making the simulation and how it came about and all that isn't really that important. It's more like, let's look at the nature of the simulation itself. What is your relationship to it? To me, that's what matters. That's where the rubber meets the road when it comes to awakening. You don't wake up through conceptualization, because that's kind of more of the same problem. The ego, let's call it the ego, the selfing mechanism, is very adaptable. It can easily adapt to new philosophies and Buddhist principles and even understanding awakening. It can adapt to that easily. So you have to, well, you don't have to, but often what helps a lot is using very precise questioning, types of questioning I might call inquiry.
Yeah.
Looking in the right place with the right kind of precision and the right, let's say, motivation, which the motivation is curiosity often. And also it's often frustration with seeing that I cause my own suffering.
And you're focusing on this personal journey, and you help people on a personal level, individual level, which is wonderful. And I think that's also very interesting to me, but I have a soft spot for these, and you know, the philosophical and scientific and broader implications of this. And this involves a lot of thinking, of course. And thinking, there's nothing wrong with thinking, but you have to understand what you're doing when you're thinking and focus your thinking. Yeah. But speaking of this spontaneity and that things just happen in the moment, if you let them, if you live in the moment, they just happen to you. I mean, for you, life happens for you, not to you. Do you think that the brain is like, comes in second here, that the things that, I mean, you're conditioned to believe that your brain thinks that now I'm going to go to the kitchen and get a glass of water. But what actually is happening is maybe that you just spontaneously, life makes you go there and get that glass of water. And then the brain afterwards interprets that as, oh, that was a decision I made. Or how does it function?
That's pretty accurate. Yeah, that's quite accurate.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think it's been shown, like through functional MRI and so forth, that what we perceive as a conscious decision, conscious meaning a thought that says I chose that. Well, first of all, without talking about functional MRI and nuanced studies, you can actually look into this in your own just day to day. I was talking about this to someone just yesterday, and I said, just notice when the thoughts about making choices actually occur. They usually occur after something happened. After you quote unquote did that. That's usually when you're talking to someone else. Oh, I did that because I chose to do that. Usually, so we actually think about choice a lot of times after the fact, which kind of really makes it's kind of interesting, isn't it? It kind of shows you the nature of thought. Thought is reflective in nature. Thought is simply reflecting the external world. Every thought you've ever had is just a combination of in talk, language you've heard, visual experiences. That's pretty much what thought is. It's not much more complicated than that. but it becomes very nuanced and complex in the language model when thoughts reflect other thoughts reflect other thoughts. And that's how we get into philosophical discussions and so forth, which are fine. I don't have a problem with that either. I know philosophers who are wide awake, a couple. I don't know how many, but I personally know at least two.
Okay. Who are they?
One of them is a sociologist. And let me think of who the philosopher was. Well, one of them is Greg Good. And I'm not sure if he's retired. You know who Greg Good is?
No, I don't. No, I'm sorry.
Oh, he's great. So his last name is Goode. He's written some books about, like, I think one's called The Direct Path. He's got some videos online, but they're about 10 years old. So he may be a retired, but he's a philosophy professor. I interviewed somebody who's a philosophy professor recently, and I can't believe I can't remember their name. But I also interviewed Maggie from Coffee Break with Your Soul, and she was a sociologist. She had a PhD in sociology. And the other person, we were just talking about this. It was the interview I did very recently with Sasha. She's an author, and she talked about being a philosophy professor working through first principles in the past. And then her life took a different turn with being an author and so forth. So anyway, there's no belief system that precludes awakening. So what I mean by that is you can be a heady person. You can be philosophical. You can be interested in doctrine and in Buddhist doctrine and in Christian mysticism. You can be Christian. You can be a devout Christian. You can be an atheist. You can be agnostic. And the reason I know all of these things, all of these types of people can wake up, is because I've seen it. I've seen all of those types of people wake up. You can be a materialist. You can be an idealist. It doesn't actually matter. So your beliefs, what your beliefs are, the content of your beliefs actually don't matter. The way you see the world doesn't actually matter. What really matters mostly with this thing that we're talking about is, first of all, tasting what we're talking about and getting a sense that it's possible. Without that, it's, you know, it may happen randomly, but it's not very common. Once you have that taste, it's more of a turning to it, a willingness to really turn to it and kind of let go into it, into the process, and then apply some technique, sometimes some kind of inquiry and so forth. That's what I see that differentiates people who wake up quickly from people who either don't or do it later or something. Which leads me back to the statement I made at the beginning, and that was awakening may not be for everyone. What I mean by that, and the reason I say that, is I never know who's going to watch these videos. I never know who's in the audience. And I don't want anyone to think I'm telling them it's a better thing if you wake up than if you don't. If you're not interested in this right now, there's something wrong with you. I want to be clear that's not the case. And it doesn't mean it's not available, because it absolutely is available. But it may just not be the right time for you. Often this is just about timing. I've had many people who come in contact with me, my books or material, or Eckhart Tolle's material, or various things, or even psychedelic experiences. They come in contact with something that triggers a knowing in them, but it's either fearful and they back off, or they just kind of overlook it. And then 5 years later, they're suddenly very interested and they start picking this up as a practice, as an orientation in life. So I really believe, not only believe it, I feel it. There's a timing to everything. And also that timing really does play into, it's a synchronicity. And once you're in synchronicity, for lack of a better way of saying it, that's when you actually experience that everything just arising out of nothing. You experience that things are spontaneously appearing, disappearing, moving just as they need to. It's quite synchronistic. Mm-hmm. And it's also integrated, that you feel it all at once. You feel the whole environment as one doing.
Yeah,
not you and the environment. There's one. The environment is doing what the environment does.
That's also very wild.
Yeah. Oh, it's wild.
The non-duality thing.
Taste it.
You know that the concept of non. There not being any separation between not only between humans, but not between anything. It's no time, no separation. And I forgot the third thing, but I actually had a brief experience of that non-separation thing the other day. I just had this feeling that, wow, maybe this is what they're talking about. I was just exiting a store that I've been to, made some shopping. I wasn't thinking of anything in particular, and I was feeling pretty relaxed, and I just crossed the street, and all of a sudden everything just seemed to be one thing. I mean, the street, the people walking on the sidewalk, and the trees around it. And it was just one kind of one scene or one stage or one, just one thing. I can't explain it in a different way than it's just one thing. And I was just kind of immersed in it. And it didn't last for more than maybe a minute or two or so, but I was just fascinated. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't scared. I think I would have been maybe 20 years ago. I had similar experiences when I was young, but then I got scared. I don't do that anymore. So I was just fascinated, but then it subsided. And would you say that was kind of an inkling?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And it's not uncommon that when this occurs, maybe out of the blue or in a deeper stage of realization, it starts to happen continuously. What often the person's response is very similar. And it's something like the longer it stays, the more you start to perceive it as it's always been like this.
Mm.
I can see how that, like, there's like a little bit of a doubt in the mind that just turns attention just a little bit into thoughts, just enough that you don't see it.
Mm.
But it's so profound when you do see it. It, like, as you, it's indescribable. Like, just as you pointed out, it's,
yeah, it very much helps that people like you have been talking about this beforehand. I mean, I've heard these stories, so that helps, because then I can kind of relate to something that somebody has talked about.
Yeah, and it's such a subtle shift in a sense in the way the perception is functioning in that moment, that if I have advice to anyone who's experiencing it or does experience it or whatever, it's not like you can impose your intention on it through a memory. You can't like make that happen again. It's much more like letting the environment come to you, or letting the environment move through you, or just being open. It's a sort of openness that does it, actually. Yeah. It's a relinquishment of will, in a sense. You're kind of giving yourself to the environment and letting the environment wash through you. And all of a sudden it just, I don't know what, it's like the key turns in the lock and everything just goes, oh, everything's one doing, one step. I'm the step, the building is taking a step, the sky is taking a step. It's all doing the same thing. The body's the sky's the body. Like, this doesn't make sense logically, but it experientially is very obvious when it's clear.
Yeah. Maybe you don't ponder quantum physics and things like that because, as you said, you this is so natural to you that it doesn't really matter if you're into science or philosophy or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just, do you ponder?
I love
it?
Quantum physics.
Yeah,
I like quantum physics, but I'm not super. I know some about it, but yeah. I can't talk at the level.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not an expert either. Of course, obviously, but I mean, I know something about people like those scientists that really made this connection between what they discovered, and it's actually 100 years ago now, and they made a connection between that and Eastern philosophy, which is the golden thread here, and the interesting point. People like David Bohm, Wolfgang Pauli, Fritjof Capra, not the least. Mm-hmm. And today we have thinkers like Bernardo Kastrup, Donald Hoffman. I'm sure you've heard about those. And
yeah,
I don't know what my question is here, really, but I mean, they say kind of like physical reality is more or less the reality that we think is physical and with separation and everything, and that it is created when it is measured, which is the famous double slit experiment and all that, but also when it's which means that it's created when it is experienced. So it's ties in with what we talked about before here about spontaneity and all that. Do you think this is what's happening, that it's created when it's experienced, or does it exist on some level before and we enter it, or I mean, doesn't it even exist before? Does that even matter?
You know, this is a really interesting question. So we're going to open up a can of worms talking about this, but I'll give you my sense of it. First of all, going back to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, ultimately is saying in some way the universe is based on indeterminacy. That jives very, very clearly with what my realization was once it kind of hit a very deep stage of realization, and that was there is no way that things are. It's this sort of indeterminacy. Bonnke calls it the unborn. I don't even know how to say it, but that's what was realized. And that was many years ago. It wasn't until maybe just a couple of years ago, someone pointed out that Nagarjuna actually said the same thing. And Of course he did. That's how it is. So that it's also, but it really, the mind is not like that, because the mind is always looking for a model and a way to make things a certain way. So there was recently the Nobel Prize was won for proving that there is no locally real universe. You see this? Yeah. The physicists showed that there's no locally real universe. And this relates all the way back to the discussion between Einstein and Bohr and the thing about, you know, spooky action at a distance and all that, right? So and they made a very good point with their paper, with their what they won the Nobel Prize for, and all of that jives with my own experience. The thing about the double slit experiment, and when you observe something, do you create it, do you cause it? It's interesting. There are various interpretations of the double slit experiment or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And many, like a lot of the way they're interpreted are based on wave collapse. The idea that once you observe it, that's when the wave collapses and there's an actuality.
It becomes a particle. Yeah.
But that's not the only interpretation. There are other interpretations. One's called the Everett interpretation. It's called many worlds. And from what I understand, based on the mathematics of it, and even using deterministic principles, that actually jives really well. But it's something that a lot of physicists don't like, because it makes it so there's nothing you can study, and that means that there's like endlessly branching worlds. There's endlessly branching other dimensions, essentially, and that's what you're experiencing when there's what appears to be a wave collapse. It's actually just that we've branched off into a different possibility, a different world, a different universe. So I'm more inclined to think that's probably true, but again, this isn't something we're ever going to prove, right? The reason is because when we talk about this, and it does relate back to insight, so there are people who have had awakenings and even speak and teach in this way. I won't name any names or anything, because I don't want to turn into a debate, but and the way that they would speak and teach is that everything is made out of consciousness, right? This would be the idealist versus the materialist. They would say the materialists are just totally wrong, that the consciousness appears out of matter. What I would say from a realization standpoint, strictly, not from a science or physics standpoint, what's happening there is there's still an attachment to human consciousness. All I can say is realization goes beyond that. And when it goes beyond that, it is like 1,000 times. It's beyond. It's something that's so indescribably strange, paradoxical, but also completely natural.
And this discussion really doesn't matter then when you get there.
Then, well, I don't know if it doesn't matter or it starts to look a little different. It starts to look a little more like the materialists maybe aren't so wrong, that human consciousness isn't that special, that things aren't made of human consciousness. Adi Shanti actually pointed this out in a very nice way. He said, you know, if you take that to the extreme, it's kind of like you're saying when I die, the whole universe dies with me, which is a nice thing people convince themselves of, but it's completely absurd. It's like if you and I are talking and Joe is standing next to us and he dies, we don't disappear, right? So you can see how identity, it goes to very subtle levels that still attach itself to consciousness. When you go beyond identity, you're talking about a whole different reality. You're talking about a reality that's when quantum field theory, when Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and the Everett interpretation start to make a lot of sense, actually. That's how it feels to me. But I can't talk about it. There's no language to talk about this. Language by its own function is just not capable of even talking about this. But I know very well when I'm talking to somebody who's realized it. It's so obvious. There's words for it. Emptiness, shunyata. It's so hard to talk about this. But
there is something.
It's not no-thingness.
Exactly. There is something. We exist, right?
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Do we have consciousness?
I'll just use some quotes for you. Actually, I did a video with Violet not too long ago talking about this very deep insight that happens. Adi Shanti's talked about it. Gangaji has talked about it. I went through it. Bernadette Roberts is a Catholic nun who wrote a book about it. It's called The Experience of No Self. It's basically when the eighth fetter in Buddhism falls. And it's a very hard thing to talk about. It's so paradoxical. It's such a deep stage of realization that even with everything that comes before it, I'm kind of using Adi Shanti's description of it now because he has a very good description of it. everything that comes before it, the Brahman consciousness, the non-dual aspect where you're literally feeling the whole entire universe functioning as you and you, the universe, all of that even collapses. What it collapses into is impossible to talk about. But I'll use a quote by Nisargadatta, and this is answering directly your question. Nisargadatta said this, and he's right on the money. He said, if you regress properly, the I am sense will disappear. And that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Adyashanti said it like this: your whole internal world completely and absolutely disappears.
So maybe we don't exist, but something exists. Maybe it's all what some people would call God, or the all-encompassing consciousness, or whatever.
I'm usually inclined to tell people I'd rather not answer the question. I'd rather let you wake up and then you tell me what you find.
Yeah.
But even to say something exists, I'm not saying I wouldn't. That to me feels too fixated still. I wouldn't even say nothing exists. To say something or nothing exists are still positions. So this goes beyond any inherent view of reality. Any inherent view of reality is fixating in nature. The things that point to this are like the Heart Sutra, where it says freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it. So you have to rid yourself of the fear of not being just as much you have to rid yourself of the fear of being. And the fear of not being, ridding yourself of the fear of formlessness is the seventh fetter in Buddhism.
Yeah.
This is deep stage stuff I'm talking about. But you kind of know. So I just wanted to.
Yeah. Well, what you're saying now could make my following questions, some of them appear a little bit superficial here. But anyway, we'll have a go at them. So you, last time we talked, we actually titled the whole episode Taking the Red Pill, because we were talking about the movie The Matrix, which many people talk about, of course, many people who are spiritually inclined and all that. And it's a good analogy, I guess. And you said that it is very much like taking the red pill in the Matrix when you wake up. But there's another film because I mean the Matrix is it's deeply philosophical, you might say. It's an adventure story and all that, but it's very philosophical. Then you have another film called The Truman Show, which is actually very similar, but it's more hands-on. It's more on a societal level, if you will, it's more like we've been lied to on a more concrete societal level. Are you in on that too, on the story of The Truman Show?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I love it. And most of the... So what we were just talking about was actually pretty deep stage realization. So there's a much smaller group of people I would talk about that to as they're going through it. It's just less common. The vast majority of people I talk to about this stuff, I'm doing one of two things. I'm either pointing through self-inquiry or like a direct process, or I'm talking about this. And this, what you're talking about, is the collective hypnosis of mind identification, the self-imposed and also groupthink imposed and societally imposed delusions of separation, of who we are, who we need to be, what we should be interested in. That stuff fascinates me. You know, it's where human psychology meets truth that goes beyond the human dimension. And where that meets, you start to see, oh my goodness, there's so much of the way our minds function, the way media functions, the way communication functions, even communication around close emotionally connected relationships. There's a lot of communication that's constantly reinforcing or reifying a sense of separate self or some sort of identity, including an identity like in a romantic couple, it might be the identity of us. In a group, it might be the identity of us, right? Like we the materialists, we the idealists, we the scientists, we the religious folks, we the Buddhists, we the Dzogchen Buddhists, we the Zen Buddhists, or we the Rinzai Zen Buddhists, we the Soto Zen Buddhists. If you think those tendencies don't affect people even at deeper stage of realization, you're overlooking the forces of delusion. The forces of delusion are very, very powerful. And so if you want a movie that points to this better than anything I've ever seen, watch the movie Revolver.
Revolver?
It's a gangster. Oh, it's awesome. It's a gangster movie, but it talks exactly about this. The whole entire movie is about this. So okay. Good. Yeah. So I love the topic of what is this self-imposed mental prison? What are the bars made out of? Who's the guard? Who's keeping the prison functioning? Who's keeping us in the prison? Who am I that's in the prison? If I'm the guard and I'm also the prisoner, how does that work up here? Mm. What is the nature of identity if there's actually different aspects of identity? I posted, I have a Facebook group called Simply Always Awake. It's a page actually on Facebook. If anyone wants to look at that, I actually posted a video by Gary Weber on there yesterday. Gary Weber is a deeply realized person, but he was also a scientist, research scientist at a very large, had a lot of different labs and a huge budget and so forth. He did a big amount of work, but he speaks in terms of neuroscience a lot. He speaks in terms of default mode network and things like that. But he also, his path used a lot of like Ramana Maharishi self-inquiry techniques and so forth. But I really like the way he talks in very, very direct ways about the way the mind functions, the way we perceive separation, distance, self and other, and self in time through brain centers, why the brain actually, this kind of comes back to your question about science. Like there is a scientific model for sure. More and more scientific evidence that there are brain centers that are actually causing us to feel as if we are in space or in time. And there's actually brain centers that cause us to have this nearly constant brain function that feels like a part of consciousness or a part of us. That is something called theory of mind, which is we're always anticipating and thinking about what other people are thinking. We're aware of another person's inner world and we're interacting with that all the time. And we can be manipulative about that. We can try to change the way we look. We can, you know, modify our image. We can say certain things that try to impress that person. We're at this game all day long, but it's just a simple brain function. So what Gary pointed out in this video, rightly so, which I've said as well in different ways, is if you think you're one identity, just look really closely. Watch your thoughts throughout the day. There's multiple identities going on. There's not in the sense of dissociative identity disorder, but there are multiple aspects of identity that come forward in different sets of circumstances. Yeah. And until you see that, it's easy to be a little unconscious because you won't even realize when you suddenly start expressing anger, when you start expressing frustration, when you start being manipulative towards somebody. And other times when you just feel relaxed and at peace, you don't realize those are different and often competing internal agendas. So the human consciousness is actually quite complex. And making a study of all these aspects of it, of the aspects of you, your own internal process, your emotions, how you react to emotions, whether you repress emotions, what your beliefs are, what your beliefs about other people are, all of that stuff will come into play in this process. So I think it's a very valuable undertaking to really start digging in and just becoming aware. Maybe we could call that mindfulness as a simple approach, but just becoming aware of what am I even thinking at any given time? Why am I believing that? Why do I believe that? How does it affect that person or my relationship with that person when I believe that I already know how they're going to react? Well, I act a certain way and then they react a certain way. I'm believing that interaction into being again and again. And we don't realize how powerful those beliefs can affect our behaviors, our interactions, all of it, even the way we see the world, even the way, even what we're interested in. Right. So the Truman Show is exactly like you said, it's much less a mystical thing. It's much more of a human game, but also it has deep implications about what's actually happening in this story of me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it resonates with people. I mean, people kind of recognize something in it that they don't really, they hadn't really thought of, but it does something to people.
Yeah. And I love that about art, like, you know, good art does.
Sometimes I think you should go to Hollywood instead of trying to read, you know, peer reviewed papers to understand things.
Yeah. Yeah. And actors, good actors know they have deep, deep understanding into the human psyche. And I think that's why a lot of people find them so, in a sense, attractive, why, you know, they get so many sort of, you know, fans, not necessarily because of the stories or the way they look, although they tend to be attractive or whatever. It's because they're coming across as so deeply authentic. Yep. And we all know that we have a depth in us that goes beyond the confines of the person we think we are. Yeah. Right, the habituated stereotyped thoughts, the stereotyped behaviors and mundane conversations we sometimes have that just don't feel deeply authentic. And yet you watch somebody who had to really break through their own emotion barriers to become someone else, to put that on a screen. I mean, that it really is a craft. It's an art form. And then you couple that with good editing, you know, a good artistic editor, a really good writer, good casting, I mean, you have something like The Truman Show, you have something like Revolver or Fight Club, or there's some really good movies that just transmit, you know? Yeah.
How unfortunate is it that our language, I mean, our, at least the Western languages, are so extremely based on separation. I mean, we talk about I, you, they, we, mm-hmm. there, here. And I'm sure that there are other cultures, other languages in the world where they maybe don't even differ between I and you. And maybe they're closer to being awake. Would you think mm-hmm. that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. A couple things. One is my experience of it is that language, as we use it, I would say is like an effect of an effect. So language is sort of an effect, the cause being thought. And thought is sort of an effect, the cause being the very fundamental sense of the way the brain processes actual separation. So what I find is what awakening is sort of going backwards through all those levels and seeing the subtler and subtler levels of thought and processing and even perception. And then you start to see, I'll say it this way. You see reality as it is, but I really hesitate to say something like that. It's not like it's a certain way, but you see things without looking through perceptual filters. Once you see that, you can see how it's constructed. Oh, I see how the mind puts together. I'm here and that's over there. And it's a practical thing. It does have practical value for sure. And then you add to that communication that I can talk to you on the other side of the world without you seeing where I'm at. And I can verbally describe that there's something over there and I'm over here and that's brown and this, I'm wearing a black shirt. And your mind is actually seeing it. That's powerful, right? And what it results in is what the human race does. We can build buildings, we can make plans, we can, so language and communication definitely have, you know, we could argue forever about the positive or negative effects of it, but it has a lot of potent effects for sure. But I see it as an effect of an effect, and the deeper levels of processing probably evolved first, and then thought probably to some degree, or fundamental thought, and then language.
So the culture that don't have these pronouns that I was mentioning here, they might have, I mean, it's the other way around. They were more awake to begin with, and then they developed mm-hmm. this kind of language.
Maybe so. And also I would say more indigenous cultures. I remember learning about this in like a philosophy class many years ago, but indigenous cultures also often have a different perception of time. So yeah. In the West, in industrialized societies, we think of time as quite linear. Like I have a certain amount of time in this life and already you feel enclosed. You already feel like you're on the clock. You know, you got to get as much stuff done as you can. You got to hit all the goals. That it's just so linear. And that can be very binding. More like primitive cultures or more indigenous cultures often have an idea about time that they would even communicate among each other that's circular. Everything's circular. Everything's a cycle. So they don't think of death as a problem. It's just what happens. Like, you know, the body grows, gets old, dies, decays, turns into soil. The soil grows the plants. We eat the plants. Everything's just interconnected. So their perception of the external and even internal world probably is more aligned with how nature actually functions, how the world and universe and the carbon cycle and nitrogen cycle, how it actually functions. And probably tend to have less anxiety and depression as a result, I would say.
Yeah, I think there are studies showing that as well. So let's talk a little bit about sense perceptions, because I mean, you focus a lot of those on those in your videos and in your book as well, which are portals to reality, I guess, or something. And you said that it's easy to grasp, you know, the notion that everything just appears in the moment when you listen to sounds and maybe also when you taste flavors and when you smells, but it's a bit trickier when you try to use your eyes. You know, that there's something with vision that seems to be trickier when it comes to, I mean, it's tricky to use vision as a portal to realization. And a very specific question coupled to that then would be that, is it easier for a blind person to get it, to reach realization?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. Actually, I don't have enough experience to know. I know a few people I've worked with who are working through this process who are like nearly blind, but have had sight. But it's from what I can think of, referencing back to these conversations, they have enough visual acuity to actually perceive separation so they can work in the visual field. I haven't worked directly with anyone who's completely blind, especially has been blind since birth to where they don't have a visual sense. My guess is their brain probably has some functioning like a visual sense, but it's experienced differently. It's not experienced through the eye.
Maybe when they dream, they see things. I don't know.
I'd have to talk to somebody like that. And maybe they would wake up easier. I can tell you this. I think I'm reasonably convinced that people who are neurodivergent wake up a little easier, and because they see and experience, especially the sense fields, in a more direct way, especially people on the autism spectrum. They seem to experience the sense fields in a more direct, non-dualistic way from the beginning. Not all of the sense fields necessarily. Sometimes it's one sense field and sometimes it's situational. And obviously that's very challenging when you're a child growing up trying to actually develop an inner world so you can interface with other inner worlds. And so that's why they often seem tuned out. They're not tuned out, but they seem like they're not paying attention to verbal cues and what other kids are doing. But if you ask, they will often say, yeah, I want to be friends with other kids. And they just don't, because there's so much sensory input that's hard to mitigate and to push away and just bury in the background so I can become an internal world and then start interacting with other people's internal worlds. So it can be very challenging growing up with that, that actually seeing the sense fields in a more direct way than the average person. And yet when it comes to awakening, they tend to do pretty well from what I've seen in my experience working with them. So, you know, I don't know how important that is, but it is something I've observed for sure.
Yeah. Interesting.
The visual sense, you're right. So I can speak to that. The visual sense is the key to non-dual realization. When I say non-dual realization, I don't mean it in terms of this whole process, like a Neo-Advaita speaker might talk about. When I say non-dual realization, I mean the very specific insight of non-dual that's irreversible. It would be considered like the sixth and seventh fetter in Buddhism, for instance, if you think in terms of fetters. It's the collapsing of the experience of separation first, and then actually space, which is form and perception. They also go. So that's when words really start failing, because again, words are sort of designed to talk about space, dimensions, here and there, self and other, and all that. But the key to it is often the visual field. Doesn't have to be, but it often is. And it's because sound is kind of already non-dualistic. If you close your eyes, you just kind of take in all the sounds in the room. You know, it doesn't feel so localized. You can think about it as localized. You can imagine a speaker across the room, or you could imagine a body here. But with your eyes closed, those are only imagined. Exactly.
That's what I do when I meditate. There's a clock that's ticking all the time, and it's like it's all over the place when I'm meditating. It's just a sound. Right. It's there, and I am the sound. I'm not thinking. I'm just feeling that I am the sound, and I am the sound of the car. I don't even think that it's a car, but there's a sound that I know is a car. But anyway, you know,
That's it. That's exactly it. And so the sound and body sensations. Body sensations are a bit situational in the sense that when you don't feel triggered, contracted, there's not a strong emotion tone. Often it's pretty easy to feel that same sort of sensation cloud with the body. It might be a little more localized because we tend to have a mental map of the body, but it's something like sound. When we're triggered, often it's much harder to do with the body, I notice, when there's strong emotion tones and so forth. But the visual field is kind of, if you have your eyes open, it's often quite fixed. Quite fixed as like, that's over there, I'm over here. That's an object over there, I know I'm a body over here. It just looks like that. Not even an afterthought, the narrative I just spoke, but the actual experience of it feels quite dualistic. And probably I think it's probably just because there's so much brain function that's constantly revved up in the occipital lobe to create that world. It requires a lot of brain function. And it's, maybe you could say it's a more complex sense, right? Sound, although I guess for some animals like owls and so forth, sound location is very important because they can hunt in the dark and so forth. But for the human, for things that are very visually oriented, sound is more like binary. It's either there or it's not. Or hearing what kind of sound tells you what made the sound, but you're not quite as concerned about the location. Whereas the visual field, you have to be precisely aware of location to function out of the visual field primarily. So the sense of self and other and objects and so forth are very clearly delineated experientially until they're not.
But it's very
so paradoxical. When that falls, go ahead.
No, just going to say that it's very paradoxical, and I know you use that word as well, so it's not just me, but it is very paradoxical when I hear you speak about these things and the way to use your senses, your sensory fields to awaken, to realize what's actually real, what's actually here. And then it sounds kind of, in a way, a bit physical or bodily or however you want to call it. You can feel that you're this body, and you can feel that there's a connection between your body and whatever you're sitting on, or there's a wind around you. You're all of it, but it's there, and that's the only thing that's real. And you see things, you hear things, you smell things, and many other spiritual pointers would rather, I guess, focus on the wish to, you know, get out of the body, so to speak, or to get rid of the body. So, you have said at some point that do you even have a body? I mean, that's maybe you said it rhetorically, but it was kind of blew my mind, because okay, so he's talking about all these sense perceptions that are important, but then he says that you might not even have a body. I mean, what are you? What is this? So what are we actually waking up to? Are we waking up to realizing that we are here in this physical world, and it's very, very concrete and very hands-on everything, and the past and the future are just illusions, but we are here now? Or are we awakening to something that is very much not physical? I mean,
it's definitely not physical. Yeah, it's definitely not physical. I think I know what you're getting at. And so, or what you're trying to ask. I emphasize the senses a lot more than a lot of teachers. And there are a couple reasons for that, but let me just say it this way. Through skillful means, in my opinion, the first awakening is the most important thing. Until that occurs, then the subtler things about the sense perceptions and non-duality will be very fleeting at best. It's just challenging. So I really do focus most of my attention, energy, most of the videos. I try to make most of the conversations about, and especially when I'm working with somebody, I really point them to that first awakening, which is a very much an expansive experience. It's awakening to consciousness. And in unbound consciousness, you do experience a sort of no body experience in a certain way. You experience, what you realize is that all the ways you thought about the world, all your paradigms, your belief about yourself and others, and all of it is just movements in consciousness. And suddenly you experience yourself as the entirety of consciousness. And that's all there is. There's just consciousness. And that's a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful place to sit for a while, you know, months, years, whatever. And you can lead yourself back to it again and again. And that doesn't go away. You always have that access. And it's a very much an expansive, a transcendent experience. Okay.
Yeah. So
that's the first step.
I get it.
That's the first step. Okay. Second, but later on, you have to go back and realize that when you're not meditating, when you're not in deep samadhi, when you're not leading yourself back to unbound consciousness, you're still actually perceiving a physical world, right? Like, it actually looks like there are physical objects in this world. When I'm these sensory investigations we're talking about, especially with the visual field, you're actually going to see through that illusion. So you're going to see there is no body, no self or other, no physicality, no separation, no perception, no form. It's the Heart Sutra. Yeah. That is non-duality. That is not imaginable. You just can't even imagine it. And it has a very different feel to it. So Adi Ashanti's made this distinction nicely. He says the first stage or the first movement of realization is up and out. The second is down and in.
Mm-hmm.
And so often a fixation happens where we love that consciousness. We love just to be not bound by our thoughts and our fears and our self-doubt, and all that stuff just gets blown out. It feels so good to be free of that. But you're not done. You're just getting started. So a good Zen teacher will tell you this. You're just getting started. So then the question is, what do you do later? How do you get through deeper stages? And it's emotion work and sensory work, in my opinion. And I'm not the only one that has this opinion. But that's largely why I do talk about that. And then the other part of why I talk about that is that some people, even with these first movements of awakening, even before awakening, for some people, too much disintegration, too much expansion or transcendence is actually the wrong way for them. It doesn't work for some people, and it can be really counterproductive for some people. So people who have a tendency to disassociate, people have a tendency to have derealization, depersonalization, if they have very avoidant personalities, any of these people, they need sensory integration as they go along. People who already have the tendency to just disassociate into formlessness, they need to have the sensory and emotional integration even through the beginning stages. So that's why I actually incorporate it in my retreats, because retreats specifically, I don't know if you've ever gone on a retreat, but if you do a sustained meditation for days, it's a whole different experience. And some people have gone to things like Vipassana retreats and had very difficult psychiatric challenges afterwards. Even suicide. Like, that's not a common one, but it's happened. And that's because there's not a lot of direction at those retreats. There's some, but there's not a lot. And there's no aftercare. And there's no teacher there. There's no realized person there that can really walk you through this stuff. So in my retreats, I really do integrate a lot of sensory integration. And I do a lot of emotional integration to, and I find it actually does accelerate even the initial awakening process, because you're not getting so expanded out that you're just disassociated, confused, lost, and whatever. So those are the two major reasons I talk about the senses so much. One is, in deep stage realization, it's a very precise and effective way to get rid of those more subtle perceptual filters, the duality filter, the one that says there's a subject here and an object there. So that's one. And then and that's why I have in my YouTube channel, it's all in playlists. And it's actually in order of these stages of realization.
Yeah.
And then number two is, I do think that doing some sensory integration, some emotion work early on is still valuable. Keeps people somewhat grounded, and especially people who tend to disassociate. You're not that person, but there are people like that. It can be harmful for them if they don't stay somewhat grounded in the sense fields and so forth. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it does make sense in the way, I mean, everything you say makes sense if you're on that level, if you're on the same page, so to speak. But it does. Do you think, this is a bit personal maybe, but I know that both you and Eckhart Tolle, who is another very known, I don't know if you're very known, but you're beginning to become known here, spiritual pointer, and you both witnessed that you had pretty depressed when you were young, and the first awakening was somewhat dramatic in a way. Do you think that it can be more gradual for people who haven't had that experience of being very sad, very depressed before awakening, and that they might not even notice at what point they actually woke up? So it's different if you're very far down into the matrix, so to speak, and then you take the red pill and it's dramatic and it's like, wow. And other people may never experience that, but they're still awake. Do you follow me?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's definitely variation in how like dramatic it is, let's say. Dramatic, just for lack of another word, how much contrast there is before and after. And it actually happens in a moment kind of thing, or in a very short time. That I would say that's definitely the rule, not the exception. It's pretty common that happens that way. The people I've worked with that I know personally, or I've worked loosely with, watching them go through the process, it tends to be a moment like that, like an event that it definitely shifts, something shifts. What's interesting is the way people perceive it is very different. They know it happened. They know something shifted. And something significantly changed, but a lot of people will really downplay it. They'll be like, "Oh no, there's no mystical this or that or anything." And like, did your experience of identity change? Oh yeah, completely. It's gone. Oh okay, well that's a little different, right? So language is confusing, and the way people describe things can vary, but it's usually pretty darn obvious. On occasion, though, I will say this: on occasion, I've met people who had actually happened 2 years ago, and if I had asked them at that time, I'm pretty sure they would have said the same thing. But something weird happens after awakening where your identity just gets thinner and thinner, and you have so little interest in talking about the past. It just seems so unreal that you kind of, it's almost like you forget you had it. It's very strange. I was in this place for years where, like, if you asked me then, it's so weird to even say this but it's true. If you asked me then, I probably would have said, well, I thought I had an awakening once, but I don't know what that was or something. It's so hard to talk about this stuff.
I kind of thought about that when I hear you interviewing people you have been working with, and you ask them a lot about their past. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about your upbringing. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
And I tend to think that, I mean, how interesting is that? But it is, of course, but it's not there anymore. So you ask them to go back in their memory bank, so to speak. And well,
you mean when I interview people about awakening?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, here's the reason I do that. The reason I do that is the ident. Okay, so most of what I do on my channel, my YouTube channel, and the book, is actually geared largely toward people who have not had an awakening and maybe don't even know what it is. They haven't heard of the subject at all. Mm-hmm. So people who have never heard of this subject, and the average person, they think in terms of stories. Stories are the most engaging thing for the mind-identified person.
Exactly.
And even if you're not mind-identified, I love a good story. Like if I see a movie that has just a really, really well-told story that touches into deep human knowledge and things, it's interesting, right? Like we're wired to like a really good story. And there's no story as good as somebody who goes from suffering to finding some kind of liberation, right? So I actually do that sort of purposely because I never know who's watching the videos and someone can relate and go, oh my God, I grew up like that. I had parents that were, right? It's not that I care like for their awakening what happened in the past because it doesn't matter. But the person I'm interviewing also knows that. Yeah. So it's more like it's to be relatable. It's the relatability of somebody who goes, oh man, I grew up in an abusive environment. Because without thinking about it, you'll often filter it out. You'll think, oh, I couldn't wake up because I had a totally unstable childhood. How could I ever wake up? And then you hear somebody who goes, yeah, I had this terribly unstable childhood and I didn't know how I was for years and I didn't do well in school and this and that. And then I had this thing happen, right? That's why I do it. So I do it it's a very specific reason.
Yeah, that's a very good reason to do that. And I suspected that you had some good reason for doing it, but because I'm not awake in the sense that I think you're pointing at here, but I have also, it's actually less and less interesting for me to talk about my past. I think it's very hazy and it's like another person or several different persons. But anyway, I know it's there. I can access the memory bank if I want to. Anyway, it's a very good segue over to my last question or maybe a couple of last questions here, because I don't know, we don't have very much time left, but this I have to skip a few questions, but this is a profound one, I think. It might be an impertinent one, but also it might also be the most profound question you can ask maybe around these things. Namely, it's about stories, exactly what you said right now. This is a synchronicity, but I mean, there are no coincidences. There are only synchronicities. Awakening is about ridding yourself of identifying with the story of you, of course, right? But I mean, life on Earth is, to a large extent, a story, as you say. And you know that NDEers, near-death experiencers, they all corroborate, you know, they confirm this famed life review that has been talked about in all times, that you have this life review just before you die. And I think that that's profound and it's very important, and it is because your life here on Earth, this physical life, is a story, basically, in a way. So it seems as if the very point of being here is to experience time, space, and separation in order to learn things, in order to grow the hard way, as it were. So I mean, waking up, isn't that like, you know, cracking the code, or like not needing to be in this three-dimensional experience anymore, like outsmarting God, if you will?
I love it. I've never heard, it's rare that I get a question I've never heard before. I've never heard a question like that. That's really funny.
I've been thinking about this a lot.
It kind of is like that.
Yeah.
It is kind of like cracking the code. There's nothing wrong with the story. I'll say it this way. Like, there's nothing wrong with living in a story. There's nothing wrong with doing it the hard way. There's nothing wrong with it. And if you're completely comfortable, it's great. That's why I tell people, you don't have, there's no need to wake up. You don't have to, it's not pertinent. No, but I will tell you, and this I can say, and this is maybe a moralistic statement, but it's a true, in my opinion, it's a very true statement. And Buddhism's all about this. That is, if you're mind identified completely, right? If you just live in the world of stories, you're completely subject to the conditions of your life. If you grew up in the right set of circumstances, you can perpetuate a massive amount of violence. And we've seen humans do this. That's the simple answer. You know, in Buddhism, they say greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly. I vow to abandon them. So at some level, when I talk about awakening, I don't usually start with a moralistic approach. I don't say you should do this because you should abandon your self-centered tendencies. No, because it's not authentic. the reason people want to wake up is because they're suffering. It's selfish. They want to stop suffering. Of course you do. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Or they have a massive curiosity about truth. And that's great too. Start with what's authentic. Don't start with, oh, I should do this because I want to be a good person, because you might be fooling yourself. With that said, as this process unfolds, you do start to sense that. And you see, when you start to see through the code, you can see how, yeah, it's really just a matter of circumstances. Like people who have really good conditions, they're going to live good lives. They'll be good people. People who have really, really bad conditions and are quite mind identified, and they have a massive amount of emotional repression, and they're influential, can cause a lot of harm in the world.
Mm. But I mean, we are different. We have different Pol Pots
of the world. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, but like, look at like an example is Pol Pot. I like Pol Pot as an example, because when I read about him, I was like fascinated. He, by all accounts, growing up, he cared about his country. He was a countryman. He cared about, and he actually believed in what he was doing. He believed communism was going to help his country and his country people and so forth. But because of repressed emotion and inability to see the effects of what he was doing, he was like starving people, killing people, millions and millions of people, because of an idea, because of an idealized way the world should be, and imposing your will upon that and your influence upon that. So that's an extreme example. But there are many not so extreme examples of people who are very harmful to their families too, mm-hmm. you know, and it has to do with being mind identified and having a set of conditions that are very detrimental to, yeah. to being a holistic, kind, compassionate human being. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it does make sense. I know you're reluctant to talk about these things, about the meaning of life and God and reincarnation and all that. But do you think, yeah. I mean... referring to what you just said here, do you think that there, I mean, because we have different conditions, we are different. Some people are more loving than others, and some people seem to be happy all their lives despite mm-hmm. not having awakened in the way that you're pointing to. But do you think that there is we come back several times in order to learn, to grow, and then when we wake up, we don't need to come back here anymore, or something.
Do I believe that's true? You mean?
Do you believe that? Yeah. Do you believe that that's the case, that this is what's going on?
Oh, you. I think a lot of that is based in a historical paradigm.
Yeah.
Hinduism turning into Buddhism, and the idea that there's the wheel of karma, there's rebirth. Reincarnation was not a theory. It was just what everyone knew was true. Of course you reincarnate. Of course you live life after life. So a lot of these Eastern traditions grew up in that. And so they're kind of steeped with it. And Buddhism is the goal of Buddhism, at least traditionally, if you were to look at the suttas, would be exactly what you just said, to end the cycle of birth and death. So you're not even reborn. There's New Age theories, of course, that are quite different. They're like, oh, you kind of have a conference with your creator before life. You decide what you're going to do. You go learn the lessons, and you leave, and then you come back. And I don't really, that doesn't vibe with me as something so real. With that said, I mean, I can't deny the existence of other lifetimes energetically, because I've experienced it. It's just obvious. But I will say, when you process that through the way our minds function with time and space and doership, which are all actually illusory, you'll see it the wrong way. That's all I can say about it. You'll see it in terms of the way the mind thinks about it. Oh, I was there. I'm floating around in space as a ghost. And then I came down into the body, and now I'm a ghost again afterwards. That's the only way the mind can make sense of that.
Yeah.
I'm more inclined to say, to look at it from a scientific perspective, like the space-time interval, which basically describes that all events are simultaneously existing.
Time and space
are relative, and causality is the only thing that's actually there, but they're simultaneously already existing. Yeah. That's more how I experience it. So, so I won't say no to my belief in other lifetimes, parallel lifetimes, things like that. I think that they actually do exist. But I will say, if you try to understand that with the mind, you're probably going to have a model of it that's not accurate at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you might misuse it to just stay mind identified. So yeah. my inclination is to tell people, wake up. If you're interested in this stuff and you really want to know, wake up, and you'll know in a way that you can't know right now.
You can't convey with words.
You'll never be able to talk about it.
You know it. Yeah.
You'll never be able to explain it to people, but you'll know what you need to know.
No, the only important thing is that you know it. I mean, knowledge, gnosis, as it were.
Yeah,
I guess. But until we can communicate telepathically, we we have to try to use words, which is very cumbersome sometimes. But how do you view the history of humankind then? Is there some kind of evolution, would you say? Or is that also a meaningless question?
Yeah, I think it sure seems like it. We're talking just in the relative sense, of course, right? When we talk about time, but it sure seems like, you know, nothing turned into something, and then something was just this bare physical, was energy, and then energy turned into matter, and then matter turned into discrete, you know, like at some point in the expansion of after the Big Bang, there was just like plasma, and then there was actual atoms, and then there was, you know, gas, and then there was stars and planets and all that, right? And so that organization has become more complex, and at some point, in at least on the Earth and probably other places in the universe, something became alive so it could actually respond to its environment in an apparently individual way, certainly not experiencing itself as an individual. But then it became so complex, it started to actually be conscious, to where it could interact with its environment in much more complex ways. It could find resources, it could move toward resources, it could move away from toxins. And then it became conscious, and then it became self-conscious. So it's hard not to say that there's some sort of evolution going on there. Now, what is the evolution beyond self-consciousness? Well, you can look at, you know, integral.
That's what I'm aiming at. Yeah.
Well, we're doing it. That's what this is about, in my opinion, in the relative sense. Like, there is something beyond this. Self-consciousness is kind of a, there's a really cool song by the group Tool. It's called 46 and 2. And what it's referring to is, Carl Jung said, human consciousness is at an unstable level of development. It needs to move forward because it's inherently uncomfortable. And that's right. Mind identification is inherently uncomfortable. Now we're starting to wake up. Well, we started to wake up probably thousands of years ago, but there was a big shift 2,500 years ago for sure. And now I think it's happening again. I was just talking to Rick Archer yesterday about this. And I think there is another sort of axial shift happening. Like, people are waking up so much more quickly. But even outside of the awakening spectrum, look at our knowledge. Look what's happening with ChatGPT and AI right now. It's insane how fast information and knowledge is being integrated and turned into incredible amounts of intelligence. And there's so much acceleration in all of this in consciousness and knowledge right now. It's fascinating. So it's hard not to see that as a sort of evolution. But to me, it just feels something like an urge. You know, it just feels like an urge to be, to know, to express, but no big deal at all. I will end with this quote by Adyashanti, which I absolutely love. And he said something like, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close. He said, everything you know, and everything we can detect, and everything that's physical, the entire universe, all of physicality, could absolutely completely disappear, and your true nature wouldn't even notice it.
Wow. Wonderful quote to note to end on. Angelo, I think I mentioned your website and all that, but please tell the audience where they can find you if they're interested in learning more about you and your work.
Sure. So the website is simplyalwaysawake.com. It's all one word, simplyalwaysawake.com. And if you're interested in retreats, including online retreats, which are quite cheap, and then in-person retreats in the United States now, at some point maybe in Europe, there's a retreats page on there, so you can check that out. Most of my ongoing material is my YouTube channel, and it's Simply Always Awake on YouTube, and you can find tons of videos. Do look at the playlists. A lot of people don't realize there's playlists, and it's depending on what you're working on, First Awakening and so forth, it's all in playlists. And then the book is Awake, It's Your Turn. It's on Amazon.
Angelo, it's been a pleasure and true joy talking to you again here.
It's been fun.
Thank you so much, and good luck now with everything.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invite, and your questions were really good. A couple of those questions I've never had before, which is uncommon.